13 verses. Not quite. We got pretty close to the end. No, we did more than six, didn't we? No? Okay. Well, you put it down. I didn't put it down. I was just from memory. Okay. Well, then, we'll go ahead with the Hebrew a little bit first, and suppose we ask, well, ask you, Mr. Gold, you're right there, take verse 7. A man who volunteers, you know, gets put on a committee to make a motion. 7. Wahith Kaddish Tom. Kaddish Tom.
Your enemies, and
they
will fall before you by
the sword. Oh, yes. 26:6. That's a problem. Excuse me just a minute. This is 20, Leviticus 26.
Yeah.
Ah, yes, I was on the wrong assignment there. 26, 1 to 13. Okay, all right, I guess no question about that. Verse 6 you did? No.
Verse 7.
Pursue your enemies, they'll fall before you with a sword. Okay, I guess no particular problem there. Your enemies, plural, pursue, rather. Okay, also 8?
Basic?
Yep.
And find from you a moment while pursue 100.
Yes.
And 100 from you a moment shall pursue 10,000?
Yeah, Ravava. We say 10,000. I'm not sure whether they counted that way. Yeah, this is a question of whether it means 10,000 or just many thousands, you know.
Right.
And I don't know that we know that much about Hebrew numerals. The question of Hebrew numerals is a big question. The Hebrew numerals in the Bible that we have are written out. I guess they're all written out. And they're clear up to 1,000. And then we have this word, Rabava, which most people would say means 10,000, but whether it means 10,000 or just a lot more than 10,000, it's hard to tell. There was a time when the Hebrew numerals were written in other ways. The Jews down in Egypt in the Elephantine papyri, now they come from around 400 B.C., quite a few papyri found in Elephantine, written in Aramaic, and the Jewish colony there. Now, they wrote in their way, but more like the Egyptians, they would write something like that for 3, you know, and they would stroke. There are various ways to write the letters. Now, that's all right for small items, but for big items, it's not so clear. They also did, in the Maccabean times, we know this from coins, they also wrote using letters for numbers. And the letters for numbers, of course, would be Aleph, the 1, and the 2, and so on. Aleph, Beis, Gimel, Dalet, He, Vav, Zayin, and so on. Yud, He, Zayin, He, and Yod. That's the first 10, and then it goes on. After Yod, the Lamed is 20, and Mem is 30, and Lamed, Yod is 10, Yod, Kaf would be 20, Lamed 30, and Mem 40, because Mem was 40. Yeah. So this is a system that is used. Interestingly, this is a system that's used in the margins of some of your Hebrew Bibles. And they will only give every 5 verses. Fifth verse would have a hey there for 5. The 10th verse would have a yod for 10. 15th verse have? It has a tape. Why? 15, yes.
The tetragrammaton.
Yes, they don't want the tetragrammaton to stay. So instead of 5-10, they have 9-6 to get away from Yod, which would be Yah, you see. Now, this is pretty clearly a late device. This avoidance of the name of God was true, of course, in New Testament times. It was not true in the early Dead Sea Scroll times. They wrote, the Dead Sea Scroll people wrote the name of God. Now, they had special reverence for it, I think I've mentioned. They would sometimes write the name of God in the old letters, whereas they'd write the other words all in the late letters, the square characters that we use. See, the Dead Sea Scrolls, many of them are square characters like what we have in the Bible. That is, pen and all, a little bit different, but that's the general thing. But they also, in the older ones, used what they call the Proto-Hebrew or Paleo-Hebrew. And that, you see, is the alphabet like this. I've memorized them all, but the base is like this. And the Kimmel is like this, and the Talmud is like this, and so on down, you see. And those are Paleo letters. Now, they are the ancestors of the square characters, but there's a little bit of a distinction between them. But at this time, in, say, 200 to 50 or so B.C., they did use letters for numerals. I've heard people, well, if they use letters for numerals, there's three things, remember. One is that this explains some mistakes that are made. Two letters that look alike. I think it's King Ahaziah. In one place he is said to be 42 years old, in another place he is said to be 22 years old. And then as much as he had to be 22, I think that his father died before he was 40. So he had to be 22, and the Septuagint says 22. In both cases, it's clearly a mistake of 40 versus 20. And 40 versus 20, and these letters would be Mame versus Kaf. Mame versus Kaf. 40 versus 20. Now, they don't look too much alike, but the Mame and the old one is like that, and the Kaf and the old one is like that. So, in the old letters, they do look alike, and quite possibly that particular corruption is due to using letters for numbers. Now, I have heard this question, whether they did use letters for numbers like that. This would argue the fact that the Septuagint has it right in both places. If the Septuagint has it right in both places, that would argue that the mistake came after the Septuagint was translated, or at least in a branch of the copying that was not dependent on the Septuagint. And that would fit very well, that it would be in this general area, say 200 to 150 B.C., that the error arose. Now, we shouldn't just change numbers right and left in the Old Testament, because we see a few changes, a few mistakes. Once or twice I've found mistakes and I've balanced my checkbook. You can make mistakes in numbers. But that doesn't mean all numbers are suspicious in the Bible. However, the how they would, now, in this later system, using Alice and so on, the system, you wonder what they did when they got up into the hundreds. Well, it goes down, I think that Tau is 300, 400, I think it's 300 is Tau. So it goes up to 20, 30, 40, 50, 60, 70, 80, 90. And then the last two or three are 100, 200, 300, 400, say. Then how do you get 500? Well, the way they got 500 was to take a 5. Hey, it would be. Right? Put a dot over it. And, well, then how do you get 5,000? You put two dots over it. Well, you see, if you use that system,
All you have to do is drop a dot and you're a thousand off. So this is another way where you can have mistakes. So it is true that the numbers in the Old Testament are more subject to textual corruption than others. Put it that way. Now, I don't mean that you should just pay no attention to the numbers. I have heard arguments that the numbers in the Bible are too big to believe. I don't go for that. But I think it is true that they are more apt to be corrupted. And this is one reason, because of the number system, and because when you're dealing with numbers, you don't have a context to go on in. Now, if you will know my address, it's 9 Homewood. And if I would sometimes by mistake write it, you would know that I've made some mistake. And right? You would suspect that. But if my telephone number was 4728, and you found out it was 4782, you would have no reason to think it was a mistake. Is that right? You have no context to correct this. You do have a context to correct this. Now, this is comment on textual criticism, you see. So, in textual criticism, I think I've argued, certainly argued elsewhere, that the Old Testament text is good. The Dead Sea Scrolls support the Old Testament text. And they also support the practice of the scribes. The scribes were good. We have a good Old Testament text and a good Masoretic text because the scribes were good. But the scribes were human and they did make an occasional mistake. And so you can try to analyze those mistakes by looking at the background and all the principles of what they did and how they did it.
So you would go on with the NIV's preference for the Septuagint over the NLT in a lot of these places.
The Dead Sea Scrolls, well, that's a very good question, and it's an important point. In the past, say 80 years ago, early part of this century, in the past, the tendency was among Orthodox scholars was to say that the Masoretic text is the text of the Hebrew Bible. Now, the Septuagint was not very good. The Septuagint differs from the Masoretic text, therefore it was not very good. If it was in the Septuagint, well, you discount that. And in fact, the New Testament, they didn't believe in verbal inspiration because they quoted from the Septuagint, which is not very good. See? So the New Testament made mistakes in quoting from the Septuagint. The Septuagint translators couldn't count them. Sometimes they were very accurate, sometimes they were very... Well, then they found the Dead Sea Scrolls. And among the Dead Sea Scrolls, they found some Hebrew scrolls that had readings like the Septuagint. And that forced them to realize that the differences between the Hebrew and the Masoretic text are not always due to bum translation on the part of the Septuagint, but they were due to differing Hebrew background texts, or logos, they call them. And then you saw that the Septuagint used a different master copy of the Hebrew than the Masoretic text did. And here they are, both of them, way back there. So the Septuagint now becomes a witness for what the Hebrew was. I mean, carefully used. You have to use your judgment, of course, but the Septuagint is a possible witness for what the Hebrew text was at 200 B.C., and it should be compared with the Masoretic text, which is later, but reflects also 200 B.C. So you have two witnesses instead of one. Now, the Masoretic text is superior and usually is the right one. But there's sometimes it makes a mistake. The Septuagint is usually all right, but sometimes, more times, it makes a mistake. But sometimes it's right when the Masoretic text is wrong. And this place is clear. And in particular, it has been argued from Dead Sea Scrolls of Samuel that the Samuel Masoretic text is particularly not so good. Septuagint Masoretic text, the Septuagint or Laga. And that comes, brings another point that is very curious. The Chronicles, the Book of Chronicles, you know, quotes Samuel Kings lots of times, whole pages. And the thing that Chronicles quotes is more often the Septuagint type than the Masoretic type. And why is that? Well, the answer has been argued that it is because the Septuagint, because the Chronicles is older. Chronicles got its quotation at an early date. And this has led critical scholars to revise their dating of Chronicles. Chronicles always used to be said to be 250 B.C. Now they're saying it's pretty close to 400 B.C., which is what Orthodox scholars have said right along. So this is kind of an involved argument, but it's a significant argument, and it repristinates the value of Chronicles. Now, to me, that's interesting, because you go to Chronicles, it refers to Moses again and again, the Law of Moses, and it's found in the Law of Moses, the books from the Law of Moses. You know. That put that witness back earlier, too. So that's very interesting.
Yes. When we talk of the LXX, we usually kind of group it in one manuscript, maybe not thinking, but in reality, wasn't it? I mean, the LXX is a composition of many that have come down to us from various translators who copied, who were different from one another, of course, and copied manuscripts. So, can you comment on the LXX as being,
unified? You're quite right. I speak broadly, broad brush, when I speak of Masoretic text versus the Septuagint text, because the Septuagint, of course, you can't use the Septuagint itself until you do some textual critical work on the Septuagint. I mean, we've got a Vaticanus Septuagint, and we've got a Sinaiticus Septuagint, and we have got an Alexandrina Septuagint. And which of these? You first have to find out what is the Septuagint text, and then is the Septuagint text good, like I say, in all books, or only in Samuel? And in the Pentateuch, it's pretty clear, the Septuagint and Masoretic texts are pretty close in the Pentateuch. But is there a different tradition, you might say, for Isaiah than for Jeremiah? The answer is probably so, but also probably we don't know. There is an area there where we have to say that maybe the Septuagint has two readings. One agrees with the Masoretic text, and one is unique. Well, then you have to look at that unique reading. Is it any good? The fact that the Septuagint agrees with the Masoretic text is possibly due to later corruption. After all, the Masoretic text, other people thought it was standard too. But if the Septuagint has a unique reading, it's worth looking at. You don't just take it because it's different, but it's worth looking at. It is, in short, it is a witness. So the Septuagint is helpful, and it is being used more now than it used to be, regarded better, and it is a witness to the Masoretic text, to the original text. And sometimes is right, not always by any means. I think most would still give the Masoretic text, it might say 90% of the doubt. But there are places where the Septuagint is preferable. One place is very obvious, is the one in Psalm 19. That's a well-known one, Psalm 19:4. Their line is going out through all the earth. It's clearly their sound is going out through all the earth. Parallel, Septuagint, New Testament, all agree. There's another place that's interesting, not so well-known. That's in Deuteronomy, where it says that all the angels of God worship Him. In Hebrews, quotes from it. That's from the Septuagint, not in the Hebrew. But it is in the Dead Sea Scrolls. They're the Dead Sea Scrolls of Deuteronomy with the Septuagint. Show the Masoretic text is lacking. The New Testament text has got the right text. So the old idea that the New Testament is wrong because it quoted the Septuagint, scholars are the ones that were wrong.
it's just the difference between a Septuagint and Masoretic text. You don't have something like the Qumran scroll or the Samaritan Pentateuch, whatever. How do you choose?
It's a good question. The answer is that textual criticism is not a science, it's an art. It's a matter of judgment. You have to go by the context. Trouble is, the context sometimes not clear. And sometimes you can't be sure. And if you can't be sure, why, most people, most Orthodox people would say take the Masoretic text. Well, that's digression, but I hope helpful. So we come back to 26, and you had finished verse 8, was it? Yeah, me too. Okay. Oh, well, let's take the rest.
The last part of it is, and your enemies shall fall before you by the sword.
Right. Okay, number 9. Mr. Gordon? Yes. I guess no particular problem there. I have regard for you. What verb is that? Yes. And it's the verb pana, lamate verb, you got the yod there. Same word for face. Actually, the word would mean turn to you. Turn to you means have regard for you. Turn to you with favor is the thing that's understood. Make you fruitful, multiply you. No problem, I think. Hakimothi, I will establish. The word is to raise up, but it is used in connection with berit regularly to establish, confirm, settle my covenant with you. Number 10 also. Yes, you shall eat yashan and noshan. How do you take those? What does yashan mean? You've had it, yes. Old. You've got yashan and noshan and another yashan. Right? You shall eat the old, and the old has become old from before the new goes out. And what it means, as you said, is that the harvest will last till the next, and this will last till the next, all year through, you'll be eating. Now, this is referred to elsewhere. I think it's in Amos, or is it Micah? In Amos, where it speaks in the millennium. In the millennium it says the harvest will last till seed, and the seed will last until harvest, and so on. We'll just keep on all year round. Yeah. Sowing. Yes, this is a blessing. A blessing in an agricultural community. Okay, 11. Mr. Zaspo? Yes.
And I will put my abode in your midst. Mm-hmm. My soul will not abhor you.
Yes, my soul will not abhor you. Is God speaking? Does God have a soul? Still want to say my soul? I think I might perhaps protest against a tendency that we all have to take a biblical word and then identify it and define it theologically in a narrow way. And then you find out that it doesn't fit the Bible anymore. God doesn't have a soul. Nefesh is the soul. But of course, nefesh is more than soul. Nefesh is the person. Nefesh is the individual. I forget where it is, but I've seen it. Nefesh in one place in the Bible is referred to a corpse. Not the non-material part of a soul, which is a theological the theological definition, you see, the soul is one thing. But the word nephesh means me, and the essential me is my soul. And so God, when he speaks, says, I. It isn't that God has a soul, God is a soul, God is an individual person. And how do you say that God is a person? We say God is a spirit. But of course, wind is not personal, but God is personal. And what do we mean when we say personal? How can we know that God is personal? Well, because we're made in his image. We can say that because we can, because we're built that way. I mean, dogs don't go around saying that. We look at the night, I think as Lewis says, we look at the night sky and we see it magnificently invested with all the grandeur, you know, of creation. He said, dog doesn't look like that. A dog bays at the moon. That's all. But man, a very beautiful passage in his book, Beyond Miracles, he says that man invests big numbers with magnificence. A big waterfall like Niagara is impressive. Small waterfalls are impressive. The big one is impressive. And he says this is kind of a shadow of eternity that falls over us and makes us do something like that. And then he says that this is that there's a reason for that. And the reason is because we're in the image of God. That we invest that with a reality because the reality is the creator who made it. So, yes, nephesh, probably here, I. Wouldn't you say? One more.
Nephesh would be also nouns.
Yes. Yes, it is. Now, I guess a key verse on that is Genesis, where it says, God breathed into man the breath of life, and he became, I think the King James says, he became a living soul. And I think the NIV there translates that, breathed into him the breath of life, and he became alive. Living creature. Check that. We thought about that pretty carefully.
Living being.
I see, we thought that that could be justified from the Hebrew. A living being. Meaning, you see, that God took the inanimate matter and made it into a man. And of course, this is against the theistic evolution idea that God took an advanced primate and made him human. The Hebrew seems to say, I know it's difficult to force Hebrew at some detail like that, but it seems to say that God took the inanimate and made it an animate man. And the nephesh is the word used. Made him a living being. So nephesh is a very interesting word and has large overtones in the translation. Well, one more. Go ahead with it. Finish it up, Mr. Aspel. 13?
12?
Yes, that's right. It is 12, isn't it?
And I will walk among you. I will be your God. You will be my
God. Right. You have a computer?
Pardon?
You have a computer?
Yes.
Want to do a word search on that sometime?
Sure.
On your God and your people. Your God and or your people. I think you'll find it a dozen times in the Bible. Do you think of some offhand? I've got a number of them written down on margin, but I've never searched it in there. You know, you don't find that in the concordance because all such common words you would need a computer phrase search for it. But it would be an interesting thing to do. In Hosea, those who are not my people shall be my people. Yes, the Lo Ami passage in Hosea 2. Isn't it? And the passage in Genesis, the Abrahamic passage, that would probably be the first one in the Bible. But again and again you find this passage. You shall be my people and I will be your God. Yes, in Devin Jeremiah. There are a number that spring to mind. But a complete printout with that would be very interesting. Maybe some of the rest of you might have started on your computers too. But it's a noble thing, a noble sentiment. You'll be my people and I'll be your God. And I'd like to emphasize that the Old Testament, we've seen it in Leviticus, where it's in Deuteronomy where it says, circumcise your hearts, and your hearts will be circumcised 2 or 3 times, Deuteronomy and Jeremiah. I think we found it in Leviticus also, where it speaks of the blood in Leviticus 19. My point is that the Old Testament is a heart religion. The Old Testament was not a religion just of sacrifice and going through the motions. Yes, yes, it is. Leviticus. Eating the blood that makes atonement for your life. Oh, you shall love your neighbor as yourself. That's the passage in Leviticus 19. Do not seek revenge, 19:18. Do not seek revenge or bear a grudge against one of your people, but love your neighbor as yourself. Now that verse is quoted in the New Testament, very famous, wonderful verse. But you look up above at verse 17. Do not hate your brother in your heart. Now, it stands out through all the Old Testament. There are a few verses like that emphasize to us that the Old Testament is a religion of the heart and the mind, and God has regard for that. The verse in the Psalm and the Proverb, the famous one, too, my son, give me thine heart. That's right, it does. And this is the one that Paul says got him. He had known all the commandments, he'd gone through all the motions. But there was that one commandment, you shall not covet. And that's a heart attitude. And his heart attitude was wrong. And that commandment convicted him. So it is true, these verses are all obvious, and yet they're very significant and should be emphasized. Okay, one more and then we're done. I think, is it? Well, we'll let somebody else take over for the last one. Who have I missed here at all? Everybody. Mr. Patain, you want to take the last one? 13?
I am the Lord. The Lord is God. Yeah, I'm the Lord of God. I brought you from the land of Egypt. I broke the bars of the yoke. And I broke the bars of your yoke.
Well, did you miss this mith yoth lahem of Adim? Brought you out from the land of Egypt. Mith yoth. What is mith?
You were slaves.
Yes. Now the mith would be a but. What's the force of the main? Or I could haya. It's the verb haya. Yes. And you have a mith before haya. Which haya is it? What form of haya is it? Hayoth. Hayoth. Lamape verbs take oath in one. No. Infinitive. It's an infinitive. It's infinitive. So what is the M? The M, you think of M as a participle, but this is not. This is a min. This is a partitive min. Or partitive, at least it's a min. Min meaning from. And if you find a preposition with a verb form, it's 99:1 infinity. From being. From being to them, servants. Now, why isn't the min, why doesn't the min make the next letter double? Isn't the min, when the n is assimilated, doesn't it usually make the next letter double? Yes, a little bit of beginning Hebrew here. It's a hey, you can't double it. the rich, of course. Yes, from being to them servants. He brought you out from the land of Egypt from being to them servants, where you were servants, we could freely say. And I broke the yoke of your neck.
Uh-huh. And I caused you to walk upright.
That's an interesting expression, isn't it? I caused you to walk upright. What's it contrasted to? Slavery. Yeah. The NIV says, caused you to walk with your head held high, I think, doesn't it? Okay. That's not exactly literal, but it certainly, well, it is literal. It's what it means. I caused you to walk upright. Erect. That's a very interesting use of the word kum there. Poleil of kum would be derived from the poleil. Yes. So this would be God's blessing. If you keep my commandments, this blessing will be on you. Any questions on the Hebrew there? You are responsible, of course, for all this Hebrew. Probably have one or two questions in the test. I have a list of questions here I'll give you, not right now, but when we come back, a list of questions for you to practice on, about 20. I won't ask all 20. I may not ask any of that 20, but I'll ask them like that 20. It'll give you something to work on. Anyhow.
Your paper's not enough.
After I read all these papers, I might think they're too much. I don't have papers from everybody. Are you coming? If you haven't turned in your paper, you should see me and make some arrangement. If it's later than 2 weeks, why, that's the number of slashes, of smacks, has increased. There is a whipping post out in the faculty offices. Well, now, to come back to the interpretation of Leviticus, we have gone through something of these commandments, the commandments of 18, 19, and 20, the laws against incest, the laws of various other kinds, and of course a lot of details we could have, but we don't have time for anything more. After that, general material. And then in chapter 23, the rest I think is rather easily studied. In chapter 23, we have the list of the feasts again. Now, these lists of the feasts of Israel are found in various places in the Bible. Maybe you've got them already, but you might note down they're in Exodus 23. They're not given in detail in Exodus 23. But there are three mentioned there, and also in Exodus 34. Exodus 34, let me turn to it. Exodus 34, beginning at verse 18, celebrate the Feast of Unleavened Bread for 7 days, and verse 22, celebrate the Feast of Weeks with the first fruits in turning of the year. The Feast of Ingathering at the turn of the year. So those three. Feast of Weeks we call Pentecost. Ingathering is elsewhere called Sukkot. Feast of Booths. And then verse 23, three times a year all your men are to appear before the Sovereign Lord. So they're mentioned there, but only mentioned in name. The three, what we call the pilgrimage feasts. And they're called pilgrimage feasts because those are the times when the men are expected to come to the temple. And they're to come not empty, they're to bring their tithe. Apparently the tithe of the early harvest, the tithe of the summer harvest, the tithe of the fruit, the grape harvest, and so on. So three times of the year they come. In Numbers 28:29, these are also listed. In Numbers 28:29, there are some details given in connection with the offerings that they're supposed to give on those days, on the Passover. Feast of Weeks, Feast of Trumpets, Day of Atonement, Feast of Tabernacles, plus the regular Sabbaths, the monthly feasts, the first of every month. First of every month, you have a feast of blowing of trumpets. The seventh month, September, a special feast of blowing of trumpets. That's a feast of trumpets given also in Leviticus. So 28 and 29... Numbers is interested particularly with the numbers of sacrifices for each one. And in the book of Deuteronomy, you have them repeated also in chapter 16 of Deuteronomy. In Leviticus, we have them, I guess you might say, from the point of view of the individuals rather than the priestly offerings. In Deuteronomy 16, the Passover, observe the month of Abib. Notice it is called the month of Abib. Why do I mention that? You have thought perhaps of Passover being in the month of Nisan. Yeah, but they don't use Nisan in the Pentateuch. That's a Babylonian month name. They use the Hebrew Canaanite month name. You don't have, in the Pentateuch, you don't have those touches of Babylonian background that you have in Ezra, Nehemiah, Chronicles, Esther. You don't have a whole plot of Persian words like you do in Esther. These things were not written in the days of Jeremiah. You don't have it. For instance, in the book of Jeremiah, you have time after time reference to the temple and to Jerusalem and its conquest and so on. The king, Jerusalem, the temple. King, Jerusalem, temple. Nothing of that in the Pentateuch. Although, according to some, Deuteronomy was written at the same time as Jeremiah. And that the P document was written in the days of Ezra and Nehemiah. But you read Ezra and Nehemiah, the background is just totally different. And one reason might be because maybe Moses wrote it. At least that's one theory. Sure. So Deuteronomy has these Passover and the Feast of Weeks, Feast of Tabernacles also, as Leviticus does. But Leviticus has these feasts and includes some details about how they're to be observed. I don't know that we need to say or have time to say anything much more about them. I want to go on to the sabbatical year, the year of Jubilee. Now see, this section that begins in chapter 23 with the Sabbath and the feasts, the sabbatical year, the year of Jubilee, this all speaks of the different seasons of the year and the years and how they are to celebrate and how they are to observe these different feasts. The Jubilee year is usually taken as every 50th year. In Leviticus 25, count off seven Sabbaths of years, seven times 7 years, so that the seven Sabbaths of years amount to a period of 49 years. Then have the trumpet sounded everywhere on the 10th day of the month. On the Day of Atonement, sound the trumpet throughout the land. Consecrate the 50th year and proclaim liberty throughout the land to all its inhabitants. That's a famous verse, verse 10. Proclaim liberty throughout the land to all its inhabitants. Somebody can tell me why that's famous, especially in this country. That's what, around the Liberty Bell. I think they took it out of context. That's still a great verse. Yeah, the 50th year, the question is that an extra year of rest beyond the seventh? See, it is mentioned the 49th year. Is it the 49th year and then one more? So that you have 2 years of rest together there. Pretty difficult for food, as a matter of fact, if you don't raise anything for 2 years, you know. Now they say the Lord will give you a blessing. Of course, the Lord would give blessing and did give blessing for the seventh year, the sabbatical year. But it is possible, and I think preferable, to take the Jubilee year as that 49th year. Now you just do that, you know, by whether you count it by an inclusive reckoning or exclusive reckoning. How many days in the week? 7 days in the week. But the first, if you count the first and the last, well, you, that's not the example. A good, better example than I think is the birth of a child in the Orient. A child in the Orient, if he's born on the 15th of December, by the 15th of January, he's a year old. 2 years old? 2 years old, yeah. Isn't that curious? Isn't that strange, their customs? Of course, with our income tax, it's the same way. A child born on the 15th of December gets the income exemption for the whole year. So the income tax is practically the same as the Oriental reckoning. Very handy. Yeah, it depends on how you count. One isn't right and the other wrong. It's a question of how you count. This is true also about on the third day. And the question is, do you count part of one day, all of the next day, part of the next day? And that is, I think, what the gospel requires. And so it's just a matter of how you count. But some people insist it has to be three full days. They agree. But I don't think that we talk that way, nor should we interpret that way. So the sabbatical year, the one question is, what about the sabbatical year? What Jubilee year? What year is it? That's a minor question. And the next question, I guess we better pick up after a few minutes and come back to the question of the Jubilee year and the sabbatical year and what they involve.